From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up, our weekly political roundup. So much to talk about, from the Central American caravan to much more. It's all coming up right after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA, with attendance only twice per term. GSEP.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. What a great day here yesterday. We had several thousand KPCC listeners come right through our Crawford Family Forum and Moan Broadcast Center to see where we do Air Talk and all our other KPCC programs. Our live broadcast yesterday at noon. Thank you for coming by and seeing it and visiting KPCC. And if you missed out, we'll be doing an open house again, probably in about a year's time. We hope you'll make time to come join us for that. Today, it's our Monday political roundup. We have much to talk about. Also, a little bit later today, Dodger fans celebrating the World Series. And we'll reconvene the triple play, A. Martinez, Nick Roman, and me, talking about the Dodger-Red Sox matchup starting tomorrow at 5 o'clock Pacific time. But first, several thousand Central American migrants making their way toward the U.S. President Trump's called it a national emergency. He claims criminals and unknown Middle Easterners, as he puts it, are part of the caravan. Well, actually traveling with the caravan until yesterday's Los Angeles Times correspondent in Latin America, Kate Linthicum. Kate, good to have you with us today.
Hey, Larry.
So share with us about the unexpected growth of the group to now an estimated 7,000 people. How did this happen?
Well, the caravan left from Honduras more than a week ago, and it was covered widely by media there and in Guatemala and other countries. And a lot of people who had been thinking about making this journey decided this was the opportunity, and some of them in just a matter of a few hours decided to leave their lives behind and go to join up with it.
You know, the Mexican government, my understanding was they were going to tell all of them that they needed to apply for refugee status, needed to be processed at a legal border crossing, but many of the individuals crossed the river at an illegal crossing into Mexico. Do we have any sense of how many have actually applied to be formally processed in Mexico?
So 1,000 people have been processed for refugee applications, and they are being detained while the Mexican government decides whether they have a good claim to asylum status. 7,000 migrants, on the other hand, appear to have crossed the border illegally. That was the number of immigrants registered at a shelter on the Mexican side of the border a couple of nights ago, and I imagine that number has gotten even higher in the days since.
And are Mexican authorities doing anything to stop the individuals since they did cross illegally and didn't go through the refugee registration process? Are police stopping them or just letting them proceed through the country?
So it's been an interesting response from Mexico. On Friday, under pressure from Trump, Mexico put on a good show for us when a group of caravan members tried to storm the official border crossing into Mexico. They responded with tear gas and riot police, and they pushed that group back from the border and basically protected their border. But then in the subsequent days, Mexican police and immigration officials stood on the banks of this river watching as literally thousands of people illegally crossed it swimming or on rafts and did nothing. And then yesterday, when the caravan kind of regrouped and started marching north into Mexico, the police were there and several times blocked the road and made it appear like they were going to stop this group of people and then suddenly retreated. I think that it could be just the sheer size of the caravan. What is 7,000 people against a couple hundred cops? It also could be because the caravan is made up of largely men, but also hundreds and hundreds of women and young children and even like 3-month-old babies. So it's just a really delicate situation.
Has there been any talk in Mexico of deploying the military to stop the caravan, or is that not on the table?
There has not. As you probably know, Mexico actually uses its military domestically quite often to try to fight drug cartels. But there has not been talk of that. Trump, on the other hand, said today that he has alerted the U.S. military and the U.S. Border Patrol to what he described as a national emergency.
All right, Kay, thank you so much. Anything else you can just add about what you observed being with the caravan over the past couple of days?
Yeah, I mean, I should say, you know, Trump today claimed that there were a large number of what he called Middle Easterners mixed in with this group. I should just say that I didn't meet a single person from the Middle East in the dozens of interviews I've done in the last couple of days. And most people I talked to were poor, looking for a better opportunity in the United States, or were fleeing violence that has become really endemic in Honduras.
A tweet from earlier today by President Trump. Sadly, it looks like Mexico's police and military are unable to stop the caravan heading to the southern border of the United States. Criminals and unknown Middle Easterners are mixed in. I've alerted Border Patrol and military that this is a national emergency. Must change laws. Kate, thank you. Appreciate your being with us and providing your on-the-scene account of some 7,000 Central American migrants as they make their way through southern Mexico. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
LA Times correspondent covering Latin America, Kate Linthicum, with us. Now, on Saturday at a campaign rally in Elko, Nevada, for Nevada Senator Dean Heller, President Trump had this to say about the caravan.
The Democrats don't care about what their extremist immigration agenda will do to your communities, to your hospitals. What about your hospitals and to your schools? The Democrats don't care that a flood of illegal immigration will bankrupt our country. You saw the site. Did anybody see that bridge over the weekend? Did you see the bridge yesterday, today? I mean, is that an incredible situation? It's sad. And it's sad, honestly, it's sad from both sides. It's sad from their side also. We're going to figure it out. I'll be honest with you. I've already figured it out. You're going to be happy. We're going to make a lot of people happy.
President Trump campaigning for Nevada U.S. Senator Dean Heller in Elko, Nevada. Joining me to talk about all the politics of the past few days, Carson Bruno, Pepperdine University, where he's assistant dean and adjunct lecturer in the School of Public Policy, former research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford as well. Carson, good to have you with us.
Good morning.
And Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, founder and chief executive officer of Rodriguez Strategies Los Angeles, former senior Obama advisor in 2008. Matt, good morning.
Good morning, Larry.
Carson, let me start with you about the caravan. President Trump has really pushed hard on the caravan and on illegal immigration during these campaign rallies. What's your sense of the traction with Republican-leaning voters?
Yeah, no, I think first definitely we need to recognize that this issue is a humanitarian crisis, not just a security and immigration issue. That has really been the focus, particularly coming out of the Trump administration, particularly around the concept of the midterm elections. But setting that aside, just from kind of looking at it through the political lens, it definitely does play to Trump's base. I mean, since very day one when he walked down or slid down that escalator, launching his presidential campaign and then throughout that entire campaign and into his presidency, the immigration issue, particularly the legal immigration issue, has been a top issue for him. It does play to his base. It plays to really kind of rally them together, really get them really motivated again. There's been a constant theme about the Democrats being a lot more motivated than the Republicans coming into the midterm elections. And we're kind of seeing that possibly being reversed and seeing a little bit more enthusiasm from the Republican base. But also, just given the nature of how blatantly illegal the caravan is acting, both with crossing the Mexican border and then heading toward the U.S. southern border, it really plays into possibly swaying some of those more moderate independent voices and voters who may not have been on that side with the Republican base.
Well, and the lack of the Mexican government really doing anything to stop it, sort of passing it on through to the U.S. to
Correct.
Deal with, that's an issue that's going to definitely rile up Trump supporters. Matt, do you think the caravan helps Republicans in the midterm?
I mean, we'll have to see when the numbers start to come out. The bottom line, immigration has been the kind of North Star for this president from the beginning. There's a variety of issues that he touches on, but immigration was the genesis of his launching of his campaign, and it has sustained him. What you're seeing in the final weeks of the campaign, you see Democrats trying to stick to issues because they've been doing very well on bread and butter issues and sort of, I don't want to say revulsion, but revulsion to a lot of what Trump has done. And so they're trying to stick to health care. They're trying to be a counterweight to Trump. They're trying to talk about society, you know, political norms and bring back sort of effective government, contrasting it with a little bit of the chaos that Trump has sort of brought over the first couple of years. Where Trump and the Republicans are trying to go is push this a little bit more culturally and sort of touchstone issues, because this is not just for Republicans. This happens most off-year elections for a president. You've won the election. It's much more difficult to get your voters out. We've seen this. Obama had historic losses in 2014, 2010. It's very rare to win in off-year elections. This goes all the way back to Franklin Roosevelt. And so it's going to be fascinating to see if Trump can do this. The Brett Kavanaugh thing was kind of a bit of a boon for them because that put it into a more cultural context where it's much more black and white for voters. And that was pushing Republicans. And they're hoping some folks were kind of soft in terms of voting, pushing them out. And now we're seeing immigration in this caravan. So he's going to be talking about crime. The Democrats are pushing folks, terrorism. Now, whether this is going to work or not, I don't know. But everything from sort of Hillary's statements and Elizabeth Warren's stuff over the last few weeks to Kavanaugh to immigration. So this is really about pumping up the Republican base and getting their voters out who have been somewhat discouraged and a Democratic base that is very, very fired up to vote in the elections this November.
We're going to talk about a number of those issues you raised, including Hillary Clinton's higher profile in the past couple of weeks, Elizabeth Warren's DNA test and more. And in fact, coming up in our second hour, we're going to open up the phones and ask you when you would be comfortable using a particular racial or ethnic background to talk about it with friends or to put it in applications or registries. How close would that relationship have to be for you to do it? The DNA test of Elizabeth Warren, 6 to 10 generations back, that there is an American Indian, Native American in her background. My question for you coming up again in our second hour is, if you've ever experienced this, at what point do you talk about it? What level of documentation would you feel or closeness that you'd feel you need to have. Right now, our focus on the top political issues. That includes, of course, the disappearance of Jamal Khashoggi, who is the dissident writer from Saudi Arabia, who disappeared inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The Turkish government claims it has documentation that Khashoggi was killed there and his body dismembered and removed from the site. This, of course, leaving the Trump administration in a difficult position. Carson Bruno, we're expecting, I guess, Turkey's report tomorrow, I believe, on this. And if it's further reinforced that people closely involved with the Saudi involved government and the Crown Prince did this, how does the president need to respond?
This is a particularly tricky situation, both for the Trump administration, but I think more broadly just for our allies in Europe who have taken a much stronger stance than the Trump administration has, but then also for players in the Middle East. I mean, this is definitely something where the details are starting to unfold, and it's hard to kind of make sure that we are getting the information not through the lens or filter of where that information is coming from, either through Turkey or through the Saudis themselves.
Does it make sense for the U.S. to do its own investigation? Because Turkey has its agenda, obviously. The Saudi royals have their agenda. Does it make sense for the U.S. to do an investigation without either agenda?
I believe that there is value there, especially given the fact that Khashoggi was living in the United States, was a columnist for the Washington Post, definitely connected to the United States in those sort of ways. So there's definitely reason for the United States to do so. But also, I think on setting aside just the details, it also would be very of value to the Trump administration, who has been very anti-press from the very beginning, also to really show that the administration is stepping up. The United States is taking the freedom of speech, freedom of the press very seriously, because there are ramifications if the administration really just doesn't follow through with this appropriately about what does that mean for the press in other locations here in the United States, but also outside the United States, who may not be as favorable to criticism.
And does Congress take this up if the administration says it's not going to do anything, Matt?
That's what I was going to say, which is Trump does not control all the pieces here, not just because of the global and geopolitical politics around this, but also the Congress. They've shown early on, they slapped extra sanctions on Russia, if you remember, early in the administration, when they didn't feel that this administration was doing enough, and Trump was sort of just playing footsie with Putin the entire time. You have many of the senators and members of Congress are very upset about this.
Of both parties.
Of both parties. This is a bipartisan issue. This is a very – you have a – you know, an opaque kingdom there. You have this Bin Salman, 33-year-old prince, who's clearly at the center of this. It's just a matter of when the story is going to come out. It's a horrifying story, potentially. I mean, whatever they're saying is clearly – it sounds like this guy was dismembered. This is something out of Homeland or some kind of Mission Impossible movie. It's really gruesome stuff. We're really right here about the press. You know, this is a sort of fundamental freedom that we look at in Western democracies. And to take this guy in and kill him because he was a dissident is not – these things happen in these countries a lot. There's a lot of violence that goes on over there. But it is particularly gruesome and particularly problematic when it is a member of the press, which is supposed to be a value that, that the Western states hold dear. But there's a lot of factors here. There's Yemen civil war. There's arms deals. There's Iran. There's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So there's just a lot that goes into the relationship with Saudi Arabia.
And there's also, you know, if the Saudi government is involved with commissioning this killing, yeah. What were they thinking that this wouldn't become an international incident?
In Turkey, who are not allies with Turkey.
Where the Turks are heavily incentivized to make this as public as possible.
Yeah.
It just, strategically, it seems absurd.
It was bizarre. This is why I think this has been so compelling, partly because I think the press is reporting on one of its own, which it should. I think they should. And also because of really the sort of movie-like scenario. You have planes flying in from Saudi Arabia. You have hit teams going into the consulate. He goes in. He doesn't come out. They don't talk about it. I think this happens on October 2nd. They don't talk about it until the 19th. So this whole thing is sort of one, it's sort of picture perfect for kind of television news and a movie. But also the underlying gruesome nature of this and playing out with a very powerful and rich country that controls a lot of the world's oil supplies. There's just a lot here, and I think a lot more to dig into over the course of the next few weeks.
Coming up on Air Talk, our political roundup, look at a New York Times report that Health and Human Services is looking at narrowing the interpretation of gender under Title IX. It was broadened in the Obama administration, largely allowing individuals to self-determine gender. We'll talk about what that change would mean, and we'll talk about Elizabeth Warren's release of her DNA, about her American Indian heritage, much more to come, as well as the midterms. Back in 1 minute on Air Talk. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. New York Times reporting that the Department of Health and Human Services is looking at its interpretation of gender under Title IX civil rights protections. Under the Obama administration, that was broadened to essentially allow for a person to self-identify his or her gender. But what HHS is apparently looking at is using a strictly biological at-birth genitalia determiner of what an individual's gender is, and that then any allegation of gender-based discrimination would be based on the anatomical determiner of gender. Carson Bruno, Pepperdine University School of Public Policy Assistant Dean. Your thoughts about the implications of Title IX enforcement under this more narrow definition?
It is interesting that this was brought up and released kind of at this time, which is a few weeks before the midterms, as Matt already mentioned. The culture wars are definitely kind of being injected into the political conversation, and I don't think we can kind of separate the two on that, especially given the timing before the midterms. However, we also have to recognize that these definitions impact people's lives, and particularly for a community such as the trans community that have a high level of discrimination, mental health issues, suicide rates, really trying to this kind of seesawing back and forth between their recognition and the definitions that really enable them to get the services that sometimes they really, really do need can be quite impactful. So it's important to always make sure that we're bringing this back away from just the esoteric of the political and what does sex and gender mean, and recognize that this is impacting individuals' lives on a very, very, very personal basis.
Well, and with the Trump administration, if it follows through with this, do you think it will help with significant numbers of evangelical voters to get them more passionate about turning out?
The interesting thing here is that I don't think that this was really a needed piece to inject into the culture wars. The evangelical right has already been galvanized and supported the Trump administration from the day one, particularly around the Supreme Court hearings. That really kind of, I think, reinjected a lot of energy into the evangelical right for the purposes of the midterms. So if we're looking through the political lens, I don't really feel like this was a necessary addition into the culture war component. So it is interesting that it was kind of released at the time that it's released.
And I just wanted to say, Carson, you're talking about the human impact of this coming up in our second hour. That's what we're going to lead off with out of NPR and Hetty's newscast, is looking at the real-world implications of the policy change. On the political side of this, Matt, does it benefit Republicans in the midterms?
I'm not sure it helps individual candidates in the midterms. What I do think Trump is doing here, and I think it's similar to his judicial picks, there are just certain bargains Trump made when he won. And around, he released a list of judges, if you remember, when he was campaigning for the 2016 presidential race. They needed some kind of an assurance that a guy who sort of had the heart of a lot of the base of the Republican Party. They loved his brashness. They loved the fact that he was sticking it to the establishment. The question was, would the establishment come around when they got into the general election after he had dispatched of all the other establishment Republicans, and say, this has got something that we could live with? And I think the judicial component of that was a huge piece of that, to say, you know what, we'll figure out how to deal with a guy who's a bit of a loose cannon, but he's going to do some of the things that we want, a huge tax cut, judges that we agree with. We've seen it in Kavanaugh. We've seen it in Gorsuch. I think this is a similar deal here. I think this is less about the candidates for 2018. I think a lot of the other stuff is the caravan. But I think this case, I think this is more about him. This is him saying, I am willing to go all the way on cultural issues. A lot of times Republicans, the culture sort of moves on, they move on. He's decided to keep pushing hard on this. There's a base of his supporters who are going to love him for that forever. So I think this is more about him and his politics than it is about the upcoming elections in November. And I think he's thinking more about 2020, saying, I gave you judges, I'm giving you this. He's fought with them on the bathroom issue.
He's following through on promises that he made.
I think he's following through, and he has no problem touching the culture wars. He enjoys touching them in a way that most politicians get nervous of. He does not.
So I wanted to ask you about Hillary Clinton, Carson Bruno. She's raised her profile over the past couple of weeks, made a number of appearances with interviews. She's made phone calls to journalists, and some Democrats have been critical of the fact that she's sort of been resurfacing. She is, in the polling that I've seen, it has a lower public approval rating than the president, which is hard to do. So your thoughts about what impact does she have on the Democratic Party by being so visible again?
Sure. So, yes, she's not the best spokeswoman for the party as the the Democratic Party is currently envisioned, particularly on the Me Too issues, the progressiveness of kind of where the party has gone. You're right. I mean, the last Gallup polling had her at 36% favorable rating,
which was astonishing, given she won the popular vote.
Exactly.
She's at 36% approval.
And even more astonishing, given the fact that you tend to see losing candidates for president get a little bit of a popularity bump after they've lost. You saw it with Romney, you saw it with McCain, and you're not really seeing it with Hillary Clinton. On the flip side, however, you have to remember that she won 25 districts that Republicans currently hold in Congress. And so Larry Sabato's crystal ball estimates that the Democrats need at least 26 seats to really win the House, and that's just kind of the minimum number. So if they're able to really go into these districts, these 25 districts that Hillary Clinton has already won for them, and the Republicans hold them, that's a good way to kind of make an effort to winning back the House, which is vital for the Democrats to really be able to interject back into the political scene at the national level.
Matt, your thoughts about Hillary Clinton's coming, resurfacing? You're expressing the early opinion I've heard from a lot of
Democrats. Yeah, yeah. Oh, boy. The issue is that Trump wants a foil. A lot of politicians do very, very well off of counterpunching and having someone to go after. He's an enormously effective – oddly enough, it seems like he's on offense, but he's actually a very effective counterpuncher, and he does better when he has boogeymen that he can go after. And the fact is the Democratic Party at some point is going to need to move on from the Clintons. Now, maybe she runs again in 2020. I don't know. Maybe Chelsea runs. But realistically, that's not going to happen. In 2020, I think the specter of the Clintons is going to exist. There's always been a fascination with what they do. Some of it fair, a lot of it unfair, but it is what it is. And so when she interjects herself into arguments, she's just a very divisive figure. Now, you can think that that's for good reasons or bad reasons, or it's unfair, but it's the reality of the situation. She's probably not helpful, because what she's really able to do is she galvanizes the Republican base like nobody galvanized the Republican base. So you see these two or three or four issues that the president is really trying to use. Now, again, we saw a Washington Post poll come out. Trump's up to 47% approval rating. That's his highest.
Think that's the economy, or what do you think?
I think part of it is the economy. I think he's been a little bit less crazy the last few weeks. I think they got the Kavanaugh thing through. I think the bottom line is a victory is a victory. They did get Kavanaugh through. I think voters did have some concerns, even though they don't like Kavanaugh. I think they had some concerns about how that played out. He's been a little bit less sort of out there, shall we say? And when he does that, and people just look at the economy, and he's been talking more about the economy, people say, well, things are really good, historically good. And so I think when he sticks to that, he tends to do pretty well. There's a lot of other storm clouds on the horizon here with him. So he's obviously a loose cannon. But I think as far as Hillary goes, she is what he wants. She's a cultural touchstone. She's become almost like her own cultural issue. She's her own issue unto herself. It's probably not helping Democrats. But the bottom line is, we're not going to get away from the Clintons as a party until there's a new nominee in 2020. And then the party's going to reset. And that's not going to happen for another year and a half or so.
Matt Rodriguez, Carson Bruno with us as we talk about the top political stories. I also wanted to ask you about the haranguing of elected officials in public places. Mitch McConnell and his wife, Elaine Chao, went out to dinner and were harangued over dinner. There have been a number of these incidents. I saw Nancy Pelosi had this happen to her recently. Carson, your thoughts on this, and at some point, are elected officials going to have to, come out against this sort of thing, or do you think people are just accepting this the way it's going to be?
On one side, you have when you run for public office, you have to expect that you're going to be in the public eye, whether that's being attacked via social media, being verbally attacked in social settings in the public. At the same time, however, we've gotten to a tenor of this sort of approach that I think could be really detrimental to politics. It could dissuade good individuals who really want to make a good impact, who are smart, who are effective, from actually running for office, because they don't want their lives or their family's lives drug through the mud or attacked when they're just trying to have a nice lunch or dinner with a family or a friend. It could then also really force politicians to start to double down on this vicious, very partisan polarization of us versus them. You're the enemy, I'm the good, which isn't good when you're talking about a democratic system and trying to get policies through that actually are helping the situation, not actually trying to pit one side versus the other side.
Republicans have complained, Matt, that some Democrats have even, you know, fueled this mm-hmm. with comments that they've made that, you know, essentially this is fair game and it's President Trump's fault and he's started it, and this is how we're going to continue. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think this is going to play out through and through 2020, actually. And I think this is actually one of the key – I think it's going to be a touchstone issue for just American politics in general over the course of the next couple of years, which is how are we supposed to engage in politics? You've got so – and this is happening really in all parts of culture and society, social media. What are you supposed to do? If you don't like someone who shot – an animal over in Africa, do you threaten them? Do you chase them? Should their lives be destroyed? Should they be ruined? We've seen this question around Me Too. We've seen this question around any people who get caught on cell phone cameras. It's now, we've seen it on college campuses, and it's now bleeding into our public life. What is, you know, what is a reaction to if someone does something that you personally, morally disagree with? How are you supposed to react to that? I don't know the answer to that. I don't think anybody does. I do think there's political risk to this because I do think watching some of the stuff that was happening around Kavanaugh and chasing people in restaurants and chasing people down the hall and banging on the Supreme Court door. You know, if you look at the history of the last 100 years, Americans don't typically like that type of stuff, even though the activists get very into it. But I think this is going to be a big issue playing out in 2020, whether you're on the Obama side of when they go low, we go high, or the Eric Holder side, when they go low, we kick them. And I think this is coming to I think this is going to be a big part of the Democratic primary in 2020.
All right, Matt, Carson, thank you both so much for being with us. Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, Carson Bruno, Assistant Dean, Pepperdine School of Public Policy. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming right up, it's the Triple Play with Nick, A, and me. We'll talk Dodger baseball, the World Series, Game 1 tomorrow. Now an update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Such a pleasure. The two gentlemen with me were with me yesterday for our open house broadcast in the noon hour. In case you missed it, hope you'll come for our next open house, probably about a year from now. But it's the Triple Play. Nick Roman of All Things Considered, A. Martinez of Take Two, yours truly, Larry Mantle. As we preview the start of the World Series tomorrow, the Dodgers did it Game 7 as their offense woke up from what had been a home run slumber. Facing a Boston team that won a franchise record number of games, team stocked with talent, with pitching too. It's going to be a tough task for the Dodgers.
And they're going to the city tomorrow and Wednesday that invented the phrase, beat L.A., beat L.A. That's when the Lakers
the
and Celtics
and
they just had an NBA Finals about 10 years ago as well. So, yeah, it is going to be definitely unfriendly, a place for the Dodgers to play. They still haven't named a Game 1 starter. It seems like it's going to be Clayton Kershaw, but please, I beg. I don't ever ask for anything, Larry. And
you want me?
I'm anyone else but
anyone
Clayton Kershaw
else?
Against
right.
that right-handed hitting power lineup of the Red Sox with the monster right there 10, 15 feet away.
Yeah. I think it's going to be Kershaw because I think they're going to look what they did against Milwaukee, which would give him a start in Game 5 in Los Angeles and then allow him to do what he did in Game 7 against Milwaukee, which is come in and be a reliever. He's got to go somewhere. He's got to go in the first two games, and they might as well do it this way. I do think that they will likely have a quick hook and then go to that bullpen, which right now is really, really pitching well. They didn't use Pedro Baez in Game 7, so he's good for a couple of innings. And Kenley Jansen only threw 20 pitches, so he may be good for a couple of innings. So they may just decide – we're just going to throw all of our really good hard-throwing guys at Boston and see what happens.
Well, and I have to say my anxiety when Pedro Baez came in has diminished somewhat. I still have a little bit of that flinch response when I see him come in from
just
the
just look at the stats the for the last 20 games or so.
I know he's looked great. The movement on his ball is there again. His confidence looks up.
You don't look confident.
But I still he makes me very, very nervous. The starting pitching matchup, you know, Chris Sale's going to go Game 1, we assume, for the Red Sox, probably against Kershaw. Your thoughts about Sale?
Well, the thing about Sale, he's also had a bit of a shoulder issue the last month and a half. So he's not a sure thing either. He would have been if the World Series was in August because he was just mowing people down. So that might also, Nick, require a short hook on the half of the Red Sox.
Yeah, and I think you're right about that. And, of course, the Dodgers have one small advantage in that they get to put one more hitter into the lineup, which would – I don't know if it's going to be Matt Kemp or David Freese. I suspect it's going to be David Freese. Just because he is really, really good against left-hand pitching, and that with Kemp, it does give you another outfielder so that you can play around a little bit and switching.
And Kemp has not been particularly hot.
But David Freese really has been, and he's got World Series experience, so that may be an advantage. We'll see. A's right. That Boston lineup, I was looking at, like, usually you'll go through a line and you go, okay, well, you stay away from this guy. And it's like, you can't walk all of these guys. You know, you got to deal with somebody in there.
Yeah, you got MVP candidate Mookie Betts, who's one of the true all-around gifted players in every part of the game. But, you know, they've had some heroic performances from people you didn't expect.
Exactly. Jackie Bradley Jr., who was kind of so-so for a lot of the season, was really good against the Houston Astros. You saw that great catch that Benintendi made to basically save a game for the Astros. They've got a lot of really good players. And that'll be something that the Dodgers are just going to have to figure out what to do with. Now, the one other advantage the Dodgers do get when they're in Los Angeles is one of those guys has to sit out, because now you play National League rules and the pitcher bats, and I don't know who that's going to be. It's probably not going to be J.D. Martinez.
No,
they're going to want that guy in the lineup, but that does mean somebody else who's pretty good has to sit down.
All right. It's the Triple Play. I'd like to hear from you, your thoughts on the Dodgers prospects against the red hot and full of talent Boston Red Sox. Boston's been good for a number of years. The Dodgers have struggled up until the past few years. So now you have these teams with loads of history that match up in the World Series. They are the teams with the strongest offenses in their respective leagues as well. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. You can also comment on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. So, A, you've been kind of the cautionary person all season
just
long.
Just call me a pessimist.
Yeah.
Call me a hater. I've heard that too.
I sense the tide has turned a bit, though. Are you feeling more optimistic?
I got to admit, they have won me over a bit. They're just plucky. They have this thing about them where they realize that maybe in a lot of these playoff series, they're not as good. I mean, if you want to look position by position, maybe you could make a case for the Brewers, even though they beat them. You look at the Red Sox, position by position, maybe the Red Sox would win, but it seems like they don't care anymore, and they're just going out there and just slugging away, and they don't care how it all winds up being, and it's turned out to be pretty good for them. So I'm starting to feel that old little Dodger blue fan in me creeping back
out. I still have reservations about the approaches at the plate. The Dodgers still seem to me to have a not very flexible, not highly analytical approach at the plate. Seems like they're going up there and looking to hit home runs in almost every at bat. And certainly Game 7 paid off. They got the long ball. But I wonder against the Red Sox if that's going to prove too limiting.
It certainly could be. I think that some experience is going to help. The fact that they were in the World Series last year will help. The fact that they've been playing nothing but pressurized games since toward the end of August, I think, will also help. But yeah, I mean, there are guys, they got grooved swings, you know. They're going to swing for this part and try and whack that ball, and it does work. It only had to work. It worked twice in Game 7 against Milwaukee, and boy, it worked big time both times. I think I have inherited some of A's lost pessimism. I am just happy with where things are. You know, I'm going to try and be just cool about no matter what happens. I'm just a
Nick,
little nervous.
The Dodger
right now.
Hater Roman.
I know. I don't want to be that, but
wasn't it great
so
though
concerned.
to see Cody Bellinger, I believe it was in game five, shorten his swing a couple of occasions at the plate, get base hits without, you know, swinging for the fence every time. And I just wonder about, you know, what you've talked about this. What is the statistically based hitting philosophy that the Dodgers are employing?
Well, they would rather swing for a home run. There is nothing in their mindset that would say, okay, with two strikes, maybe we should shorten up. It almost feels to them as if they're giving up an opportunity for a larger outcome, which is why they do what they do. Now, the Red Sox are similar in that they employ the same strategy, except with two strikes, they actually go back to say, okay, how about some contact, keep the trains moving, keep this thing going around the base paths. That's the one big difference between the two. But as you said, Larry, the Dodgers are capable of it. They show them they can do
they
it. I just wish they would believe it themselves.
Well, that whole thing with the bunt from Machado in that game the other day against Milwaukee, which then allowed Bellinger to come up and hit the ball for a home run, you're up all of a sudden, a 1-0 game becomes 2-1 Dodgers, and that forced everything then that happened for the Milwaukee Brewers.
I was weeping. I was crying with joy.
It was such an extraordinary and rare event. And was it Buehler who put that great sacrifice bunt down the first baseline?
Yeah, it was tremendous. Yeah.
That was like, whoa, great bat control there. All right, it's the triple play. We're talking about the Dodgers, Red Sox, Game 1, Fenway Park, Boston, tomorrow, 5 o'clock Pacific time. Our phone lines are open for you if you want to assess the Dodgers' chances against the Sox, 866-893-KPECC. Our producer, Matt D'Angelo-Antonio, feels this is very not in keeping with Air Talk. It's highly biased. He's a Red Sox fan and believes that should be represented here. No, there is total slant on this segment, and we're going to rant, too. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Larry Mantle with A. Martinez, Nick Roman. It's the triple play. We're talking the World Series, the Dodgers' second straight year in the series. Last year, obviously against a dynamite team, the Houston Astros, who I thought would give the Red Sox quite a bit more of a run in the American League Championship Series, but that one only went 5, the Red Sox eliminating the Astros, who I thought were better this year than last year. And now the Dodgers have to take on the Red Sox. Michael in Newport Beach, how do you handicap the series?
Yeah, just first of all, good show, you guys. I liked what Mr. Roberts did there in that shaking up in that Game 7 with his lineup. And before you get too far away from Boston being all that great, they are only a 30-step line in Vegas. And if you know a 7-game series, that is almost a pick 'em. The Dodgers, it's a nickel. They're only 30 cents, which means Las Vegas it's damn near a pick 'em. So don't get too far.
Okay.
Pretty good at this.
All right. Of course, the Dodgers are the larger media market, closer to Vegas. That may have some effect on the line there, too. And the Red Sox with home field advantage in the series because they had the better regular season. What, they won 108
games? 108 games, yeah.
Yeah, which is
monster.
Very, very hard to do.
Again, remember that the American League was loaded with lousy teams. I mean, the Baltimore Orioles were awful. Who else was really?
Royals were terrible.
The Royals were terrible. The White Sox.
Four good teams, arguably, in the American League.
Yeah, and so the numbers are a little bit skewed there, and I knew that coming in, I think I said one time earlier that coming into the playoffs, the Red Sox were like 1 game above 500 against playoff teams, and the Dodgers were winning 2 out of 3 against playoff teams. It really doesn't make much difference now where we are. I mean, it all depends on who's hot, who's doing well, who's healthy. And so we'll see.
How much does the eccentric nature of Fenway Park factor into this? Because my sense is that in playoff series, the visiting teams struggle a bit with the oddities of the park.
In 2004, the Dodgers went to Fenway for an interleague game, interleague series. That was Frank McCourt's first big return back to Boston. And a lot of the Dodger players, especially the pitchers, they wanted to be on the mound. This was hours before the game, just to feel what it was like to have that at their back. They'd never experienced it before. They didn't know what it was like, especially ones that had never been in the American League, really. So they actually had to get accustomed to how it feels. It is a shoebox, and it feels that way where you're right in the middle, as opposed to Dodger Stadium, which is very wide open, and you almost feel like you're in a prairie. So
it's
there
like
is a difference.
To
oh,
Dodger
there's a huge
Stadium.
Difference. Yeah, they do have to get accustomed to it.
Yeah, so I was trying to think. So Chris Taylor, he'd played in the American League, right?
Yeah. No, but briefly, just briefly.
Yeah, trying to think which Dodger outfielders.
None of the outfielders, I don't think, have had any real significant.
Kemp's a National Leaguer,
Yeah, they're all now in terms of hitters. I mean, Machado has been there many, many times, and Brian Dozier as well. So there's a chance that they'll know what to do against the pitchers and know how to handle that and not get lured into, you know, wow, if I just pull that ball, it's going to, you know. Years and years and years ago, Orlando Cepeda, the great player for MVP for the St. Louis Cardinals, went in there, and people thought he was going to hit a zillion home runs in the World Series. Did nothing.
Yeah. And the pitchers have to worry about that, too, because they feel that thing right behind them. So the left-handers, do they pitch to avoid someone pulling it? And how do they figure out exactly what happens when that thing is so ever-present? If you haven't seen Fenway Park out there, you got take a look at a picture on Google Images. It is odd if you've never seen that big, giant green monster just lingering over the field. It's quite a sight.
It's weird. And when you're in Boston, you see how Fenway is situated. It's like it's just wedged in. It makes Wrigley look expansive.
Yeah.
The way it's Fenway is just, you know, wedged into the block on which it sits. I wonder about the effect on shifts. For those who aren't baseball fans, this hat where you move your defensive players around to play to the tendencies of hitters where they typically hit the ball. But I wonder if the odd dimensions of Fenway, does that have an effect, you think, on where players position themselves?
It's hard to say. I think that, you know, the number one thing that you have to just keep remembering is you can't look at that wall. You have to look at the batter, and you have to pitch to that guy and make sure that that guy does what he doesn't want to do. And so I don't think the Dodgers will change too much. Certainly on the left-handers, they're gonna shift on all the left-hand hitters for sure.
There's a lot of space, though, in right center, though.
Yeah.
There's a lot of real estate in right center. In left field, not so much because that wall just kind of juts through to center field.
And you don't want to be tricked by that right field line because it's kind of funky. You can hit... You can hit a home run, sort of curve one around
Pesky's
that
pole, Johnny Pesky,
yeah. And so it looks like wow, there's a lot of room out there. I can hit something. The fence by the bullpens is very low, so you know a line drive could go right over it, and so can an outfielder. So you know it's a weird kind of place, and you just hope that you pitch as well as possible. A lot of left-handers get real intimidated there too.
I think Julio Urias, the young pitcher who's come back from having his shoulder rebuilt, I think he could be a real key here. Now, he wasn't even on the roster in the divisional playoff series, but pitched, had at least two appearances in the championship series.
I'm not sure he's going to be on the roster.
Really?
Well, the only reason is because Scott Alexander has tons of American League experience.
Ah.
And so I was thinking about this,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I thought Urias, though, looked pretty good.
He does look good, and so they may have to make a decision about – you know, I don't know if Alexander was held out because he's not healthy or because they just felt it was a better matchup. But I would suspect that American League experience that Scott Alexander has would put him on the roster. But we'll see.
Yeah, it makes sense.
The only other part that I'm thinking about, too, is that the Dodgers are going to spend the next 2 days in Boston. And I'm just thinking about all the different Laker players that I've talked to over the years about those final series in Boston, I would not eat any hotel food. I would. Red Sox fans work in these hotels.
Yeah. Yes. Do you remember when Kobe, was that Sacramento when he got food poisoning?
You
from,
never know, right?
From,
just bring your own food.
Allegedly from the hotel. Yeah. Allegedly. Kobe got sick. And that was in a playoff series,
as I
recall.
Magic even thinks he got sick once.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, the one good advantage that the Dodgers have is that, you know, Babe Ruth is not playing in this World Series like he did that other one back in 1916.
I don't know if I ever told you the story. My great-grandfather got on the train from Los Angeles to go to Chicago to see my grandfather, his son, graduate from medical school, right? Medical School in Chicago. And as he gets on the train in Los Angeles, sees the newspaper that Babe Ruth is going to be playing at Comiskey Park. The Yankees are in town. So guess what he did instead of go to his son's graduation from medical school?
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
I might actually agree with him on that
one.
Yeah.
Well, when am I ever going to have a chance to see Babe Ruth play in person? And he ditched his own son's medical school graduation.
Right.
The power of Babe Ruth. All right. Proudly told that story when my grandfather wasn't in the room. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Thank you, gentlemen. As always, the triple play. You'll be hearing from him in a few days.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, offering an online hybrid format in West LA with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start January 7th. Apply by November 1st to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us today. I so appreciate your listening, whether you're using our KPCC app or listening to 89.3 or online at kpcc.org. Later this hour, we'll talk with Alex Villanueva, who's candidate for Los Angeles County Sheriff. He was a member of the department for more than three decades. He finished second in the primary election, so he's in the runoff against the incumbent, Jim McDonald. We'll talk with Alex Villanueva, candidate for Los Angeles County Sheriff, coming up just a little bit later this hour. And we'll also open up the phones. I want to ask you, in light of Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts senator's releasing the DNA analysis of her background, that she had a distant relative who was American Indian. I'm going to ask you if you're someone who has a particular background of a race or ethnicity, whether you share that with friends, whether it's something you've ever put on an application. How close does it have to be for you to talk about that or to formally use that? That's coming up later this hour. But we begin with the New York Times breaking a story over the weekend that the Department of Health and Human Services is considering narrowing the definition of gender under Title IX federal law. This would have to do with discrimination that's based on gender. With us, education correspondent for the New York Times, Erica L. Green. Erica, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
How is this proposed narrowing of the definition of gender? How would it be determined under this proposal?
Under the proposal that was drafted and circulated and has been pushed for several months by the Department of Health and Human Services, the government would essentially define gender and gender-based harassment based on male or female, and based on, you know, whether a person was born male or female at birth. And they would prove, you know, they have proposed to prove this through birth certificates that as they were originally issued. And kind of the most extreme part of the proposal is that, you know, those birth certificates could be rebutted by genetic testing.
Now, you report that this changed under the Obama administration. How was gender defined, or was it defined, before the Obama administration opened this up to essentially allow individuals to self-identify gender?
It wasn't really defined at all. Sex was a standalone in the statute. And, you know, everyone had presumed that there was a binary understanding of what it meant. Under the Obama administration, agencies interpreted sex to include gender identity. The Obama administration issued several policy decisions in several agencies that, you know, determined as such that the administration would treat it as covering gender identity. And now what we see is the Trump administration's efforts to rein that in.
So if it were to be changed in this way, if you had someone who didn't identify as being either gender, and that person was allegedly discriminated against because they didn't identify as either male or female, would there be any protection under Title IX?
Well, that's what's unclear, and that's what many of the folks who have come out against this, that's a question that they've raised for folks who aren't, you know, necessarily in the category of being transgender, but intersex and other medical conditions. When you start to narrowly define sex as male or female, not only does it exclude a group of folks, but it also completely, you know, fails to recognize another group. So that is one of the looming questions with such a narrow definition.
What is the path for enacting this change in definition?
So the Justice Department would receive a proposed definition from HHS, which our sources tell us they have been expecting for some time now and expect by the end of the year. If the DOJ accepts this definition and renders it legal, then, you know, the Attorney General would issue a legal opinion to all agency heads, and they would adopt it as it applies to their statutes and policies. So that would be the process. In terms of regulation, you know, that usually is quite an involved process. So if, for example, the Education Department were to include this definition in their Title IX regulations coming down the pike, that would be subject to a 60-day comment period and kind of go through the regulatory process here in Washington. But a legal opinion from the DOJ is the law, is really kind of the legal opinion of the land, and agencies would be expected to adopt that.
Erica, thanks so much for sharing with us your reporting on this. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
New York Times education correspondent Erica L. Green, The Times, breaking this story about the Department of Health and Human Services. Also with us from Lambda Legal in their D.C. office, Sasha Bookert. Thank you very much, Sasha, for being with us.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for having me on your program.
So your thoughts, how would this affect, first of all, trans Americans? Would they potentially not be covered by discrimination under Title IX?
Yeah, no. Very, very definitively no. What it does do is it sends a terrible message to transgender and gender nonconforming people across the country that the government does not have their back. The Department of Health and Human Services memo is completely out of step with Supreme Court precedent and over 2 years of case law that clearly has established that sex is not defined in the way they think it does. You know, this all stems from a case that the Supreme Court heard involving, it wasn't a transgender woman, it was a woman who was up for a promotion, and her employer said, you know, you need to, you know, be more feminine. You need to go to charm school. They literally told her she needed to doll it up. And she refused, and she brought her case forward, and her employer made the argument that HHS is arguing that somehow sex is not, it does not include gender stereotypes about how a man or a woman should behave, but it should be strictly construed to be some kind of dystopian definition that restricts it. Sex so tightly that it eliminates transgender people, and the Supreme Court said, no, that's not going to fly. And since that was decided in 1989, we've seen case after case. Just in the last year, we've seen several move forward that, you know, clearly undermines this notion that sex can be understood that way. So, but again, it does send a terrible message, you know, that...
So it's more symbolic as you see it than a practical effect.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's part of, you know, this administration has a clear hostility towards transgender people, whether you're talking about an open transgender military service, rescinding the guidance for transgender students, trying to remove us from the census, telling the Center for Disease Control that they can't use the word transgender. I mean, if that isn't clear animus targeting our community, I don't know what is. But yeah, this is definitely sending a message.
We're talking with Lambda Legal staff attorney Sasha Bookert. Also with us, Brad Dacus, president and founder of the Pacific Justice Institute that's based in California. Mr. Dacus, good to have you with us again. Do you think this would be a substantive change?
No, actually, it wouldn't, and I'm really surprised about some of the responses I just heard. The fact is, Title IX has been long defined as a matter of in terms of case law, as well as regulatory enforcement, as well as a legal definition of sex to be based on biology. It wasn't, and this has gone on for decades, it wasn't until President Obama decided to unilaterally somehow try to change the definition that we have this controversy. The fact is, this was legislation. Title IX was passed by the legislature, by Congress, signed into law by the president, respected for decades. This is simply undoing an out-of-line effort by President Obama to somehow change the law unilaterally, which is totally disrespectful for our whole legal concept. As far as you mentioned, like as far as like case law, there's cases that no, there's no case law interpreting Title IX mandating that redefining sex as a matter of case law. Absolutely not. In fact, it's quite the contrary. And as far as medical protections, they say, well, people with medical conditions, we're not talking about people who have adrenal insensitivity syndrome. Those are very, very rare. That's biological, and that's determined in terms of from that end. We're talking about people with a mental condition, gender identity dysphoria, where they think of themselves differently than what every single cell in their body says what they are. That's what we're dealing with, and the issue here is one of civil rights as well. Title IX was there. The purpose was to protect women, young girls, to have an equal opportunity when it comes to sports, athletic competition. This interpretation turns that completely on its head and deprives young women. For example, in California, a young woman was booted off a basketball team, couldn't play basketball because a male, biological male, who thought he was a female, but a biological male with all the advantages of masculinity, of being a male, took her place instead. That is exactly what Title IX is there to prevent, to protect the civil rights and opportunities of young women who have different bodies and different advantages and disadvantages with regards to males.
Our Brad Dacus with us of the Pacific Justice Institute. Sasha Booker, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I just don't understand what case law Brad's referring to, but the case law I read is clearly shown, referring to Whitaker v. Kenosha, a decision just 2 years ago, you know, that clearly held that prohibiting a student from using a restroom consistent with their gender identity is a violation of Title IX. It's pretty clear. And that builds on, you know, again, decades of case law that is found under Title VII, under the Affordable Care Act, under any provision that prohibits sex discrimination, includes a discrimination based on gender stereotypes.
Also about his characterization of essentially in the majority of cases, this is a psychological condition, as he described it, not something that's biological.
Yeah, and no, we hear that argument a lot, and the idea is to restrict the definition so tightly that you force transgender people into the shadows. But he's wrong. You know, he's wrong both on the law, and he's also wrong on medicine. You know, we've submitted many declarations from, you know, physicians. I'm not a doctor, so this isn't my area of specialties, and I'm guessing it isn't his either. But, you know, people understand sex to be more complicated than, you know, the narrow myopic way that, you know, he's seeking to define it. You know, sex encompasses all kinds of things, like your hormonal levels, your sexual orientation, your gender identity, your genetics, you know, et cetera. And it's, you know, there, as you mentioned, there are people with different conditions that have different chromosomal makeups. But again, the main point is that this flies directly into the face of 25 years of case law that holds that sex is not understood in the way that he thinks it is.
Brad Dacus, how would this play out here in California, where there are specific protections for transgender Californians? Would this have any effect here?
Yeah, I first have to comment on that. And I know Sasha is not an attorney, and I totally respect that. But the reality is, sex has been defined for decades by, in terms of regulations, as well as case law, pursuant to Title IX, as being biological, period. President Obama is the one who thwarted that unilaterally, a total disregard for the legal process and the concept of adoption of law. As far as California goes, the state of California would be impacted in terms of federal funding. School districts, specifically school districts and states that decide not to comply with Title IX, are subject to losing federal funding. And that is something that the state of California is going to have to weigh in whether or not which way they want to follow that. You know, as far as the concept of equal treatment, to females and the disadvantage to females. That's the purpose of Title IX, so that they are not shunned off the basketball team by someone who's a biological male. He said it's hard to define. There's all these factors. No, biologically, medically speaking, genetically speaking, you're either XX or XY. It's manifest in terms of brain development as well as sexual organ development, bone structural development, and it's all unanimously in agreement. It is a mental psychological condition, gender identity dysphoria, DMS4, DMS5, validate that. So we need to be truthful and honest with what we're dealing with. At the same time, we do need to have compassion and understanding for those who have dysphoria. It's a real condition. 41% will commit suicide in their lifetime. It's very serious. And it should ignore it as well. So saying, no, we need to have compassion, we need understanding, but we need to also be fair and not abuse a federal law, Title IX, that was intended to protect the civil rights of particularly of.
Okay. I just want to clarify, too, you might have misheard, Brad, but Sasha was saying she wasn't a doctor, but she is an attorney, staff attorney at Lambda Legal. So,
I stand corrected on that. But I assure you, as this matter gets prolonged and is litigated, there is the case law and the court and the Supreme Court will back up the historical definition of sex as it's been defined, as it was defined.
I need a break. Brad Dacus of the Pacific Justice Institute, thank you so much for being with us. Sasha Booker, Lambda Legal, quick closing comment on where you see this going.
Oh, I just want to say that, you know, I know that, you know, folks like to blame everything on Obama, but again, the case law has been in place for over 25 years. And, you know, if this ever sees the light of day in any kind of rule, we will challenge it and we will prevail.
All right. Thank you both very much. That's Sasha Bookert, staff attorney at Lambda Legal in D.C. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we talk with candidate for Los Angeles County Sheriff Alex Villanueva. Will be with us. He retired after 32 years with the Sheriff's Department. He's former lieutenant with that agency, and he is now running against incumbent Sheriff Jim McDonald. We'll talk with him about his candidacy and the Sheriff's Department. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. We hope you're getting ready for Election Day with the KPCC voter game plan. Everything you need to know, ballot proposition, the candidates' races, local measures. You'll find it at elections.laist.com. That's elections.laist.com. You'll get the very latest information. We also have online for you our voter cram session. Every California ballot measure, all 11 of them, in less than an hour's listening time, you can rip right through it with your sample ballot in hand and figure out how you want to vote on those ballot measures. Our panel of experts weighs in, gives you all the pros and cons, who's behind and who's in opposition to each of the ballot measures, just a way to help prepare you to vote in a way that reflects your views. Well, joining us now, candidate for Los Angeles County Sheriff Alex Villanueva. He has served for 32 years in the Sheriff's Department, reaching the rank of lieutenant, and he faces off with incumbent County Sheriff Jim McDonald. Mr. Villanueva, thank you for joining us again. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk, first of all, about what you would bring to the department if you were elected. What would be among the first couple of changes you would make if you were elected to the job?
One thing I have to do is I have to fix a corrupt system of employment practice that actually got us into the trouble under Lee Bach and Paul Tanaka. For some reason, the incumbent decided to leave it intact. All of the policies, the practices, the procedures that allowed unethical people to gain control of the entire organization, those exact same practices still remain in place today. I have to change the entire thing to convert a cronyism system into a merit-driven system that serves the community.
Well, with the Sheriff's Department previously, the allegation was that Lee Baca didn't choose people who had the kind of integrity required of doing the positions. Things were covered up, cliques formed and the like. You think that's happening today?
Oh, yes, it's happened. In fact, the Paul Tanaka was a result of what Lee Baca failed to do. Now we have 20 Paul Tanakas spread throughout the department.
So it sounds like you'd do a house cleaning. You'd be
You'd
be reassigning a number of the top administrative staff of the department.
Those that are do not have civil service protection, which are ranks of division chief and above, I'm going to clean house.
Really? And what do you see as the evidence that they're not competent to do those jobs?
Well, we are a dysfunctional organization. We are a shrinking organization. We cannot recruit people to the job. People currently in the job are leaving early, electing early retirement instead of working under the oppressive regime of Jim McDonald. And the reason why they're doing it is because they have no faith either in his leadership or that of the command staff. All of the problems that we have today are a direct result of his decisions and the command staff that still remains intact from the years of Lee Bach and Paul Tanaka. Paul Tanaka's foot soldiers are Jim McDonald's command staff.
And let's take the jails as an example. So previously in the jails, there's serious problem with deputies who were assigned to the jails engaging in physical abuse of the inmates. Sheriff McDonald claims this problem has been corrected. What do you see in the jails?
Well, he's being dishonest when he claims it's been corrected because that problem was at its height in 2009. After the Citizens Commission on Jail Violence, after the Commander's Management Task Force, all these different efforts that happened way before Jim McDonald showed up, it was addressed. In fact, when I was a watch commander in one of the jail systems, I saw our use of forces drop 50% in 1 year alone. So he claims that forces down 60% since 2009 is dishonest because he came into office at the end of 2014. Those 5 years, a lot of changes occurred, and actually the system was stabilized. But what has happened since he's been in office now, we've had a destabilized jail environment because now use of force of inmates on inmates is going up steadily. In fact, it's skyrocketing. Use of force of inmates on staff is going up through the roof. Gassing, where inmates throw urine and feces at employees, is a common practice now. Happens almost on a daily basis. Assaults, some violent assaults that have occurred where employees have been very seriously injured. I have to look no further than the case of the custody assistant at Lakewood Jail, who was beaten to a bloody pulp by an inmate, and it was twice her size. A deputy at Twin Towers facility had her ear partially bitten off, had her scalp torn off, and she was beaten pretty badly, obviously severely wounded, by an inmate who was both HIV and hepatitis C positive. These are the things that rarely make the press because he's spending his time touting how use of force is down in the jails. But there's three components to violence in the jail system, and he's ignoring two of the ones that are just going unchecked.
So that's you're talking about inmate-on-inmate violence and inmate-on-staff violence.
Exactly.
And you're saying that that is getting worse. And do you think that that is related to the fewer incidents of use of force of staff on inmates? Is that directly related?
It's related to the policies of Jim McDonald tying the hands of deputies where they're afraid to even defend themselves. That is how critical the situation is today. We cannot allow the system to return to what it was in 2009, by no means. However, we cannot allow it to go so far out of control in the other direction. There has to be a happy medium where the entire population in the jail, both the inmates, the employees, are safe.
We're talking with Alex Villanueva. He's candidate for Los Angeles County Sheriff. He's facing the incumbent Jim McDonald. Mr. Villanueva, let's talk more about the jails because it's such a major part of the responsibility of the sheriff in Los Angeles County. Currently deputies, when they join the department, are expected to do the rotation within the jail before they move out to patrol duties. Is that something that you would change if elected sheriff?
Yes, I want to change. I want to get to the point where I can recruit people to go straight into patrol and avoid working in jail because I'm losing a lot of applicants, good quality applicants, because they refuse to work in the jail system.
So they're going to police departments where they don't have to do jail
precisely
duty.
Yes, and I want to get them. I want to have those who want to work in custody have a career in custody. We're going to have that. We're going to incentivize working custody so we remain it fully staffed. However, we have to be able to track quality recruits that are going elsewhere and have them work straight into patrol.
And is that something where you think it needs to be sworn deputies who serve in those positions in the jails who choose to do so? Or could this be done by civilian employees who come in similar to how prison guards work in the state system?
It needs to be a combination of the two. The inmate population, as a result of prison realignment, AB 109, has left us a very volatile prison population with a lot of serious violent predators.
who are now in county custody.
They're now in county custody, where normally they would have been briefly in our custody and then off to the state prison system. So our the composition of our prison population or the jail population has been changing over time because of AB 109. So it makes a lot of the tensions, it exacerbates them. The threat level that the inmate population poses to the staff, particularly our civilian staff, our nursing staff, the clinicians,
psychologists,
all these people that provide care for mentally ill.
I guess I wonder, well, what does it make sense to have new recruits, even if they want to work in the jail, at sworn deputies go into the jails? Would it make more sense to have career custody people in those jobs instead of people who want to get into law enforcement particularly?
We need to have a mixture of them. I have no problem actually having a career path for those who want to remain in custody. When it comes to the leadership, supervision of the custody environment, however, there's no greater proving grounds and training than actually working in a patrol environment where you have to encounter a lot of situations. You had to do a lot of critical decision-making with very few resources. You're not in a controlled environment, and you learn to actually manage situations, well, critical incidents well. That translates very, very well when you have supervision in a custody environment.
We're talking with Alex Villanueva, the challenger to incumbent L.A. County Sheriff Jim McDonnell. If you have questions for him, you can put it on our AirTalk page, kpecc.org. One of the central points of your candidacy is that under Sheriff McDonnell, recruitment has fallen off significantly, and you've got many, many open positions that have gone unfilled. The sheriff says this is a problem that isn't just the sheriff's department. Every law enforcement agency is having a difficult time recruiting enough people who are going to pass through all the requirements to get into law enforcement. So, you know, what's your response to the point that everybody in law enforcement is having this challenge?
Everyone has those same pressures of our youth today are really not interested in law enforcement as they were in the past. Public sector has to compete with the private sector, particularly when you have a very, very low unemployment rate. However, our department is the only one facing severe understaffing to the point where 1,500 deputies under what we were supposed to be, and we're shrinking. Last year, 2017, we actually had 100 employees less than when we started the year. This year, we achieved that mark, a dubious distinction, in the first 6 months alone of 2018. So we're on pace to lose 200 deputies by the end of 2018. So we're a shrinking department that's directly related to Jim McDonnell's mass firing spree. You cannot hire and recruit people to an organization when you're bragging about how many people you're firing.
Well, but is the firing because he sees it as changing the culture of the organization that needs change?
No, that is straight. It's literally a political relations stunt, all it is. He's trying to create a pile of career heads that he's decapitated. However, when you look at how many cases that he's losing when these cases are challenged in civil service commissions, when they're challenged in superior court.
When people appeal their firings.
Right, and they lose them, and the taxpayer pays dearly because they have to pay for the time they were away from work, which they were compensated. If they were fired and then they have all their back pay with interest, they get that back. Plus, we lost their service during that time, and the court costs are enormous.
I also wanted to ask you about managerial experience. One of the things that the sheriff has said, he's pointed out the fact you really haven't had high-level managerial experience. You reached, I believe, the level of lieutenant in the department, long career, 32 years with LASD. But if you're going to manage a department with the thousands of employees and the complexity of the county sheriff's department, what are the ways that you're going to get yourself up to speed, develop those managerial chops to lead a department this big if you're elected?
Well, I can start by saying being a military vetting, being a commissioned officer in the military with 32 years of institutional knowledge, I've seen for over three decades how bad the department is being led by their executive staff and now by the current sheriff. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out there's a right way to do the job. And he doesn't really understand. I know he likes to say, oh, I've only led 18 people out of the department, which apparently he doesn't understand the scope of responsibilities of lieutenants on his own department, because some of them, in fact, 95% of the chiefs of police throughout the entire nation have less responsibilities than a shift watch commander at some of our larger facilities. That's how big the organization is. But I'll take 18 people led well in the right direction versus 18,000 people led wrong.
Okay, but my question to you is, I mean, there's still going to be a learning curve. If you're elected to this position, I don't think anybody would go into a managerial challenge like this and just, you know, feel right away they're up to speed. So what is your plan if you're elected to get up to speed on the scope of the department?
Well, one is I have to recruit some talent from outside the department, expertise that we currently don't have. I am also going to recruit some retired executives who have left in disgust, and they're willing to sacrifice a few years. They're already a little bit older in age. They want to come back. They want to help me fix the department. I'm going to surround myself with a command executive staff that knows what they're doing. They're going to provide me good, you know, good guidance on what I'm going to do. Of course, there's a learning curve. There's a learning curve when a certain community organizer became president of the United States. And guess what? The buses ran on time. Everything happened. We were well defended. As becoming sheriff, that means we're still going to be answering our 911 calls. We're still going to be dispatching units. We're still going to be investigating crimes. We're still going to be managing our jail systems. We're going to start repairing all the damage that has happened over the last 20 years. It's going to take a lot of work from a lot of people, and I have a very solid vision of how we can bring this department forward, and that's reform, rebuild, and restore. That's my platform in the very beginning, and I've articulated each and every component of it. And we're going to get the job done.
Mr. Villanueva, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Alex Villanueva is candidate for Los Angeles County Sheriff. He's facing the incumbent, Jim McDonnell. Sheriff McDonnell is scheduled to join us as well on a one-on-one conversation. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Last week, with Senator Elizabeth Warren coming out with her DNA test, showing that well back in her family's history, there was a Native American. My question for you is, if you've had maybe a family history passed down generationally about particular racial or ethnic background, have you talked about that? Have you felt confident in it? Have you even tested for it and perhaps used it on applications or to get into school? I want to hear from you, your experience with it at 866-893-KPCC. Back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Such a pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. Terry's in conversation with actor and comedian Melissa McCarthy. Her new film, Can You Ever Forgive Me?, is a biographical comedy about a woman, a real-life woman, who was a biographer of famous people and then became a literary forger. Melissa McCarthy talks not only about her new film, but about her breakout performance in Bridesmaids, growing up on a farm, and much more. That's with Terry Gross, Fresh Air, coming up right here on 89.3 KPCC. Well, U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts had been described by Harvard University and by the University of Pennsylvania, where she'd been affiliated, as a professor of Native American background. She was listed in a legal registry as having Native American background. That led to President Trump mocking her, questioning that background. So last week, Senator Warren released a DNA test in an effort to back up her claim to Native ancestry.
And we will very gently take that kit and we will slowly toss it.
Be very gentle.
And we will say, I will give you $1 million to your favorite charity, paid for by Trump, if you take the test and it shows you're an Indian. You know.
Hi, this is Elizabeth Warren. Is Dr. Bustamante in, please?
Hi, I'm Carlos Bustamante, and I've advised companies in the direct-to-consumer space, including Ancestry.com, 23andMe, and Helix. In the Senator's genome, we did find 5 segments of Native American ancestry with very high confidence, where we believe the error rate is less than 1 in 1,000.
Now, the president likes to call my mom a liar. What do the facts say?
Facts suggest that you
absolutely have a Native American ancestor in your pedigree.
So what the analysis found was that somewhere between 6 and 10 generations back in her lineage, Elizabeth Warren had someone who was Native American, indigenous to the Americas, in her background. And so she touted that as proof that there was no deception, that in fact was her background. Now, my question for you is, when would you feel comfortable using that in your background? Some might say 6 to 10 generations is so far back that it's so diluted, so to speak, you wouldn't necessarily identify in a professional registry that you are of that background. But a lot of families have passed down stories about people in their background, whether it's someone who's African-American or from an Asian-American country in the background or Native American. This is a very common part of our mixed American experience where there is intermarriage historically. So my question for you is, at what point would you feel comfortable using it? In some cases, it might be to people that are close to you. Maybe you wouldn't, you know, make a public deal out of it. Other cases, maybe you would feel comfortable putting it on an application to school or for a registry that's devoted to people of a particular racial or ethnic culture. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org, 866-893-5722. At what point in your lineage would you feel comfortable sharing that you have, you know, someone in your background as though that's a significant part of who you are? TJ in Atwater Village, you're on Air Talk.
Yes, hi, thanks. I would feel comfortable on an application if it met the criteria of what the tribe set the standard as.
So tribal registration would be the standard for you.
Correct. My family's like about 3% Cherokee, and I was a member of the Native American Caucus at Screen Actors Guild, and we had redheads and all kinds of people, and no one cared the percentage, especially the Cherokee was a big inclusive tribe. So as long as we were doing good works and not trying to game the system. And I married into a family where they were from Cuba, and they like to say that they're Cuban. They don't speak Spanish. They don't know the music. They don't cook the food. So the people can be what they want to be as long as they're not trying to game the system.
That's interesting. So for you, it's really a matter of cultural affiliation. And so you think of yourself as Cherokee, at least in part, and you're involved in Native American causes. So you feel like that's authentic.
Correct. And I'm not using it to get ahead of any other minority or majority group either.
And you're not tribally registered, correct?
Correct.
All right. TJ, I appreciate it very much. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. And again, I know a lot of people have strong feelings about Elizabeth Warren, whether the senator is correct or not to identify herself as having Native American ancestry, whether so many generations back that would be potentially relevant or not. My question is really flipping this around, as I'm asking you, because I think there'd be all different points of view. When would you feel comfortable about sharing this with friends or talking about it more widely? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. And let us know how this would play out in your family. And it wouldn't even necessarily have to be racial or ethnic. I had the experience where in my family, I had heard from my grandmother and from others about how my ancestors were very prominently involved in the abolitionist movement in Michigan. And I was very interested in that. But I didn't really have any confirmation of that until I came across, just online doing my own searching, finding that I believe it was my great-great-great-great aunt was actually someone who took slaves who had escaped from the South in her wagon, covered them up, and took them to the final terminus in the U.S. before they would go into Canada on the Underground Railroad. And she did it because, as a woman, she would be, you know, less stand out. But I was interested, before I would, you know, talk about something like that, of interest in my family background, I want some degree of verification, because there are a lot of family stories that, who knows whether they're authentic or not. There are probably a lot of families where there are stories of people having American Indian background where there really isn't any or very much there. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Maybe it's a family background. You were told you had a distant ancestor who fought in a particular war. Is that something you felt comfortable talking about if it was part of family lore? Without having sort of any independent corroboration of that. 866-893-KPECC. Danielle in Duarte, what point do you feel comfortable talking about that sort of family ancestry?
I talk about it a lot because my dad is white and my mom, would just say, is Dutch Indonesian. And I'm like 15 different ethnicities. I'm this melting pot. And when people look at me, I get questions a lot about what ethnicity I am because people can't pinpoint it. So over the years, it's kind of changed. And I actually recently took a DNA test randomly.
Yeah.
And so we say my mom's side were Dutch Indonesian. My mom was born there. But ethnically, we actually, my DNA kind of confirmed we don't have really any Dutch at all.
Yeah.
Just because they colonized Indonesia and they came over. It's a whole family story. But over time, what I say is kind of tailored, especially on forms, to what the options are. Because I used to put Asian sometimes, and then Pacific Islander started popping up, so I would mark that.
Yeah.
Sometimes when I got sick of that, because I am half white and I'm very, I consider myself just American, I would put other and write in American. And now there's an option for two or more races. So I mostly just put that. But it's been fluid over the years.
And Danielle, like you, we only get more mixed as a people, right? We only intermarry more and more and more. And then to try and document who we are and to, quantify that can be very, very difficult. Appreciate you sharing that. Yeah, getting a DNA test can be eye-opening as well. 866-893-KPECC. So was there a particular percentage or particular closeness that you would feel necessary if you were going to claim that you were part of a particular racial or ethnic group, national group in your background, and how close would you feel that would have to be? 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about Senator Elizabeth Warren's DNA test as she attempted to counter President Trump's claim that she was falsely asserting she was of American Indian background. And the senator, after doing a DNA analysis, showed that she had American Indian background 6 to 10 generations ago. So question is, at what point do you share that? Is that close enough that you'd feel comfortable saying, yeah, I'm part Native American or Indigenous American, depending on how the DNA test is considered? Or would you feel like that's so diffused that you wouldn't really bring that up? 866-893-KPECC. Jazz Chaos on the page, but do we inherit good or bad of our ancestors? What if your relatives owned slaves? Do you inherit their guilt? Well, that's an interesting point because, as you recall, a few years ago on the PBS series Finding Our Roots, the actor Ben Affleck had his DNA analyzed and his genealogy traced and found that in his family background there were slave owners. And he, as I recall, attempted to have that omitted from the final program. And once that was disclosed, he later apologized for that. But it appears he felt embarrassed about that as though somehow that reflected negatively on him that he had ancestors who were slave owners or to feel, the opposite. If you had, family members who were abolitionists, would you necessarily feel pride? It doesn't really affect us personally what we do, whether we behave in a moral or immoral way. It is interesting in our family background to see who's notorious or who's done something that's noteworthy and maybe a source of familial pride. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jordan in Huntington Beach. So how close would this have to be in your family background for you to feel you could claim it?
Well, my family background's a bit unique. My mother's grandfather was a Native American. I won't name the tribe, but he was, you know, listed within the tribal registry. Even today, our family surname is accessible on there. And so we grew up with the knowledge that we had some Native American background. Having said that, my mother's mother was born with bright red hair. You know, she was born into a rocky marriage, and we always assumed that even though, you know, per the birth certificate, she was half Native American, that just wasn't adding up. So we took a DNA test not too long ago, and it disproved the birth certificate, and it proved our family theory that we were not significantly Native American. You know, there was some trace percentage there, but it wasn't a result of my great-grandfather.
Yeah.
And so we no longer self-identify as Native American, despite my mother growing up with a full Native American grandfather, knowing a lot about the tribe. He was pretty involved in their tribe. She no longer self-identifies as that. And so I guess for me, yeah, we did have some trace Native American or trace Sub-Saharan African, which is pretty common for Americans.
It's sure.
Genealogy forums. But,
well, it brings up, though, Jordan, the issue that our earlier caller made, that who's been very active in Native American causes. You know, his point is that the percentage in one's makeup isn't anywhere near as important as the cultural affiliation and choices an individual makes. And so, what do you think about that? Given the assumption of your was it your grandmother?
So it was my mother's grandfather.
And mother's grand, yeah.
The point is accurate. My mother still donates to tribal causes, but I don't think she can still be an ally of tribal rights and that movement without self-identifying as Native American. I mean, the science kind of disproved that she was, and I think it wasn't a huge surprise to her, let's put it that way. I mean, her mother had bright red hair, and I don't think we were shocked. So it was probably different for her than somebody like really believed her family history. And you know, look, if Elizabeth Warren's DNA test came back and it said that, that's fine. I think what she could say, and I don't think she did it with ill intent, was, look, my family history was this. It appears it may have been embellished or
yeah.
inaccurate. I didn't do it maliciously. And I think people would get on board with that.
And that would have felt, I think, a little straighter to say, you know, well, it is technically accurate, but, you know, not to the degree that I was led to believe. I appreciate it, Jordan. Good to have you with us. Pasadena Ed writes on the page, if I was greater than 25% Native, I would claim I'm part Native, but I'd never claim to be Native American. If less than 25%, I wouldn't even mention it unless we were doing a deep dive into our respective genealogies. Let's take another call. This from Elaine in Studio City. Elaine, real briefly, please. At how close would a particular race or ethnicity have to be in your background for you to claim it?
I think it depends on how you live your life. This is a little bit what you were just discussing with the other caller. I'm half Asian and half Hispanic, but I look more Asian. I have an Asian last name, and I don't feel at all Hispanic. So it would feel false to me, even though I'm just one generation.
Yeah.
It would feel false to me to say I'm Hispanic or to try to take advantage of that in some way because of the way that I live my life. So for me, I love Elizabeth Warren. I'm a progressive. but I have a hard time because I, at least from the outside, it seems like she lives her life as a white woman. And that, I don't know, maybe she celebrates Native American history in her household and we don't know about that. But it feels a little...
Well, and it's interesting that you are half Latino, but don't really identify just because that's not really the culture that you grew up with. Again, speaks to that issue. Elaine, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Good to have you with us, Elaine in Studio City. I want to thank all our other callers, Amy in Echo Park and David in Koreatown. Sorry we weren't able to get to your calls, but I do appreciate your being with us. You can share your comments about this on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org, and let us know your thoughts. When you'd feel comfortable claiming a particular race or ethnicity, how close would that have to be to your own generation? Fresh Air with Terry Gross, our guest Melissa McCarthy, coming right up here on 89.3 KPCC. Back with you tomorrow.